Good morning, everybody. As you can see here, my name is Derek Cameron. I work at Allstate. I didn't put that up here. I'm not sure why. We're going to be talking about what I called empowering business users with Shiny. So if you do care about stalking me or whatever, afterwards and all that other stuff. And that was the past 1 second. Okay, so what do we mean when we say empowering business users? Obviously, that's a very loaded word, so I put it in quotes and we'll kind of define it a little bit later. We'll talk about a couple of examples of how we've used Shiny and Allstate to engage our business partners in doing analytics, and then just some general observations. And so, at least in my mind, when I say empowering business users, I mean helping them make more informed decisions with data. It's no fun being in a position where they have to come to you to help them solve their problems. You want to give them a way to help themselves, essentially, because then it's a lot easier to have some type of exponential scaling up over time. And so, at least in my mind, it's something that's not often mentioned in things like this, is you have to build relationships with the people that you're working with. It's very hard for you to work with people who don't trust you at some level, have trust in the types of work that you're doing, and at least in my mind, you can do that by just being transparent about what you're doing, at least as much as you can, and also sharing ownership. And so, at least in my mind, Shiny can be a really good tool for building these relationships, and essentially what it kind of forces me to do is create a feedback loop in between me and the people that I'm working with, so that it's not just some transactional relationship where they say, hey, I've got this problem. I say, okay, here you go, here's the solution. And so why Shiny? Here, that's an easy case to make. You've got ours, active open source community. There's relatively low barrier to entry. You don't have to know HTML, CSS, JavaScript to build a very pretty Shiny app. And plus, you get to exploit your existing R code. Everybody here probably has some amount of R code for doing things. And so, first example we're going to talk about is exploring messy data. So this is something you almost always have to do, and in this particular case, we're trying to work with a technology group that wants to proactively identify server outages. So Allstate's a big company, has a huge technological infrastructure, and when something goes down, it can be a big deal, right? That means an agent can't quote somebody. And so the data in this case was user documented, and hence it's very messy. If you've ever worked with data that humans generate, it's generally awful to work with. And so things like this is like recent changes to servers, assigned resources, meeting notes, all sorts of things like that. And our business partners had some experience working with this data, but didn't have the tool set to go as deep as they wanted to. And so Shiny helped us in this case to collaborate with our business users to easily explore and understand this data. And so on our side, as a data scientist, I get to leverage their perspective on how this data is generated because they work directly with people who document this type of work. And they get to leverage our experience working with data. And so here's kind of what this app looks like. You can see in the top left, we affectionately named it Dora because who's the most famous explorer you can think of? And so you've got, you know, a list here of things that you can modify. Here's a plot. You've got a sidebar on the left that lets you do trends, all sorts of stuff like that. And that's actually something we use across a few different areas. So the second example is delivery models. So we had something we want to do with claims adjusters. They want to be able to make faster decisions. Like within, say, the first few days of someone opening a claim. Opening a claim is a major touch point for an insurance company, so it's very important that we handle that as well and as fast as that we can. And so in this case, we had a mixture of closed and free-form data on claims, such as the involved parties, assessed damages, case notes, things like that. And so claims adjusters are very familiar with this type of data, but they want to try to be able to make faster decisions, and that's what we try to help them do. So in this case, Shiny helped us quickly create a prototype to help us provide estimates on claim amount. And so what this did is it lets them update incorrect information. We get to leverage their perspective on claims cases, so like the qualitative stuff that's very just hard to measure, like from conversations they've had with claimants. So here's kind of what it looks like. I had to black everything out because you guys don't have the right clearance. But just to kind of give you an idea is you can put up a claim number at the top, you get all this information, they can correct it and do update, and then down here we kind of provide a recommendation. And then what the claims adjuster gets to do is say, you know, did we follow it, did we not follow your recommendation, and why, so that over time we can kind of build up something that is hopefully going to be useful to people. And so in my experience, to close this out, Shiny is a very good supplement for this type of work, but it doesn't replace great work. And so the biggest thing is strategic direction. You don't just want to create a Shiny app just because you can create a Shiny app. That's pretty easy to do. You want to make sure you know exactly what you need to do.
mention myself, Miranda Morlock, and postdoc I'm working with Vincent Mellor. We're a very small team and very, very casual people. The initial concept came from an idea I had when I was at a conference. Managed to get invited, I got the funding, we started school. We are aiming to cross the digital divide and to make a site that is for African scientists, agricultural scientists. So what's our niche? Our niche is that we have graduates in masters, PhDs in agricultural sciences up in the School of Agriculture. They have a basic knowledge of statistical techniques. We have free R software, which is, you know, in standards and fantastic and getting better all the time. Our niche is a practical application focused on agricultural scientists in Africa. This is the site. So the most important thing about this is it's yieldingresults.org, all one word, all lowercase. And here we are. The most important part is the course modules, and we have a support and FAQ where we have some technical asides. Keeping it as simple as possible because it's for Africa. So the concept we're aiming at is the nexus between our software and combining that with your integrating, designing your experiment and analysing your experiment, so you haven't got to be an absolute expert. It's for people who are trained but they're back in the field. They're in the field, they're remote. We want it to be simple, accessible. We're crossing that digital divide. Statistics is a really, you know, it's a way of thinking, but it's got a lot of jargon. We need to get that level right so that we are able to use practical coding and they can actually design something. And we have introduced this idea of a little bit of in-depth or revision and in-depth content if people need it. So we have the opportunity there. We also do have challenges and we're currently developing it, so we haven't done all the, this is a module, you don't need to read the detail. The first two there, 0 and 1, are about loading up your software, starting from the basics. A little bit more about Excel. And the other challenge we have is awareness, and we will be having a challenge of evaluating it because we want to get more money. So the first module is getting started. It's about using R. I've only been using R for 2 years, so it's object-orientated. That was a bit of a challenge for me. Load, explore, getting ready for the course, in fact, installing it and reminding yourself about Excel. So the basic module one is exploratory data analysis. So we've got things like principles of design, sampling, links from design to output, planning your research question, some summary statistics, the real basic stuff that hopefully you already know, but it's just helping you to gradually get into the course, starting with small steps. Module two is analysis of variance, and that's very important in agriculture. So we're covering things like 2 levels of randomization with split plots, 2 levels of blocking with Latin squares. We've got R about design, principles of design, and we go on to mean separation and interpreting and writing up of the data. Regression, we're focusing really on is your data ready for regression? Let's do some linear regression, model building, and looking at outputs. Later on, we're going to probably add some more stuff in for logistic. That's not used as much in agriculture. Interpreting except regression. Interpretation is very important, of course, for the practical person. Survey design, we're very broad, you can see, because in Africa you do household surveys to do some of your intervention work. So it's about research questions and analysis. It's about designing a question, a little bit about stratification and simple random sampling, looking at your methods for observation data. And that's that one. Plotting in R, obviously really important. But again, we're going to just do some simple plots, good practice, getting ready for plotting, ggplot and lattice, obviously, and a few case studies. We can't do everything. We're going to try and just get people to sort of scaffold on what they know, if you like. So our issues are, will it be used? We want to evaluate, obviously, a representative sample of users. Is it really accessible? I'm even thinking, do we need it to be on a USB port, USB drive, so it's more accessible and portable? And how do I keep my funding going? I've got 2 years funding through the ACR, Australian funding, and I want to keep it going. I think we can move over to Asia. So please remember my site, it's yieldingresults.org, and love to have people's input, comments, questions, and tell people in Africa and Asia it's there. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Jan-Philipp Korb, and I'm from Germany. This is my fourth user conference, and I always enjoy it because this conference I learned most from. And I want to present my work on R and OpenStreetMap data. So this is the outline. It's quite comprehensive, but I want to try to manage it. I want to present my institute and then the main packages I used for my work. And of course, I also want to present the OpenStreetMap project and then the packages of MAR and SP for geographic data. This is what is the GESIS. We do consultants for public finance projects in Germany and Europe. And this is our data life cycle, so we do consultants on data and information research, survey planning and design, data collection and preparation, data registration, and so on. A few years ago, I developed my interest on working with geographic data, and that is because of a presentation of David Cale at the USAR in Nashville in 2012 on the GGMap package, and this package can be used to download information from the OpenStreetMap project. So what is it? It's a Web 2.0 mapping application, a free project where geographical information is collected by volunteers, and that is a big data treasure. One information which can be retrieved from OpenStreetMap is the geocode. You can do this with the GGMap package, but there's also an OpenStreetMap API, and there are several packages which use this API. Then there is another package which is quite important, where we can retrieve more detailed information, and that package is called OSMAR. And with this package, we can download, for example, polygons of buildings, and then transfer it to a spatial object. We use this for example, for our telephone surveys to judge about the coverage of our surveys. So we have geocoded the telephone register here for one city in Germany, and you can compare it with the number of buildings, for example, per grid. Then we have several possibilities in R to visualize the information. One example, which is quite helpful, is the TMAP package. This is one way to visualize these polygons of buildings, for example. One important API of the OpenStreetMap project is the Overpass API, and here that acts as a database over the web, and it has a very powerful query language, and I use this API to create my own project, and I also used the package XML, because you get XML information from this API, and you have to process the information, because with XML data, it's quite difficult to analyze. This is one example of the generators in Germany, so different sources of energy, and you have here the key value pair, which is there are many more pairs available, and these are the different generator sources in Germany. Another example, which I visualized here with the GGMap package, is the fast food restaurants for California. And you can see a list of all available OpenStreetMap features in the internet. So that's quite comprehensive. So as an outlook, conclusion, we have online mapping services, which are a great data treasure. And with R, we have a wide variety of analysis options, and we can also use interfaces to other programs and languages to process that information. If you have questions about my presentations, please contact me or have a look at my GitHub repository. You can also find my package right here on geo data instead of geo data. looking forward to graduating.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. What is a meta-analysis? Not everyone might actually know what a meta-analysis is. A meta-analysis is just a way of combining effect sizes. It allows you to actually do an analysis, and creating a summary of research findings. So some common uses. The most important one is for uses in the medical field. Oftentimes, you'll take a bunch of studies from a treatment or a drug trial, and you'll combine them all into one group. That way, it's more efficient than running one large actual trial. The social sciences and education researchers also use this a lot as well. We use it to look at effects over a large set of populations to see if there's actually one true effect. Some of the features of MAVIS, it's mostly designed to work as a pedagogical tool, so teaching people how to run a meta-analysis. It's all done in a web browser. There's multiple ways to detect publication bias, including Eggers regression and the Bay-Hedges weight function model. One of the goals is to help lower the learning curve for people who are first learning how to do a meta-analysis. A lot of times people who start learning how to do these kind of methods are first or second year graduate students, and they haven't actually been exposed to R yet. So removing any of these kind of barriers is, I think, a good thing. It's all open source, anyone can use it. I've already put this online, I'll show it at the very end for anyone to use. Currently, a lot of our users are either in the Arab world or in Spain, so it's Latin America, close enough. and so we're working on some translations for that. Barak's translated MAVIS into Turkish already for people there. So the front end, clearly it's obviously Shiny, and a Shiny ACE is used to let people enter data. A lot of Shiny apps have people upload a CSV file, but I found it's kind of troublesome. It's kind of a barrier for entry for people who aren't used to using more advanced methods, so we use Shiny ACE to do data entry. And Shiny VS is just used to enhance for warnings. The back end, where it gets kind of complicated, Wolfgang Fischbauer, who I think has the greatest name ever, wrote the Metaphor package. It's been said about 1,400 times. It's a great package, and it does basically everything. There's also some single case design work added to this, because someone asked once. Since I can't really do the Shiny app, I just took some screenshots. Here's what it looks like. With the Shiny ACE interface up here at the top. We have some menus that we'll go through in a second, and we get to see actually your sampling variance and effect sizes. This is actually a real meta-analysis from Clinical Psychology Review, so if you actually want to go and look at it, you can see it as results. Here are the forest plots and the funnel plots for publication bias. As you can see, even if you don't know what a meta-analysis is, there's all the point estimates with confidence intervals, and then we have a standardized mean difference at the very bottom. You also can download all these plots, which I thought was a little frustrating to program in, but finally worked. Since it's a pedagogical tool, there are input examples. So we have another example from other meta-analyses we pulled the data out of. So people can just copy and paste, or they can work it out of an Excel file or any other spreadsheet program to help actually collect all these effect sizes. And here's an example of our publication bias section. We can basically take almost everything out of the Metaphor package and just connect it up with Shiny. We have some include file drawer analyses and some of the other trim and fill options. The joy of awkward silences, right? And here are all the effect size calculators. I've used about four different packages just to sort of combine it all into one group. This is the fanciest looking one. This is for single case design work, so people can actually effect sizes based off of these, but also we have things like t-tests, regressions, etc. Here's all the documentation. It's all available on GitHub. There's also the Turkish versions on GitHub, and it's an online demo at my website, kylehamilton.com. Kylehamilton.net is just my DigitalOcean droplet, so you can check that out. And I think that's my last. Oh, I have one more slide.
Want to thank my co-authors, Barak and Mizumoto. Mizumoto wrote the original version of Mavis like, as a package for his book. And Barak and I took it and really expanded and built on it. So really great for him. Want to thank my advisor, Linda Cameron, and my lab, the Health Communications Lab at UC Merced. Thank you.
We have one seat up here.
This is actually my intro slide. I didn't make an intro slide, so I'm Steve Bob. I'll be talking about a package called Madness. If you can click on those links, you can find them on GitHub or GitHub. But it's basically a package for multivariate automatic differentiation. So what do I mean by multivariate? You can have a function that takes a multivariate array, matrix input, makes a matrix output, and then it creates, it actually automatically computes the derivative, which is a matrix. So the idea is it should act just like a numeric, and the derivatives are computed for you. You can just apply a function, whatever you want, and hopefully the derivative will be computed. So these are computed via forward accumulation and the chain rule. There's no fancy tricks like NXT, non-standard valuation. And because of the structure, it's an S4 object. The package is actually named for the S4 system. So the primary use case is the multivariate delta method. So if you have some consistent estimator by the central limit theorem, and you want to apply some function to it, you can get a consistent estimator of some function of your parameter, and you have to wrap the covariance with these derivatives. So the idea was allow the user to compute f and automatically compute the derivatives. So that was the primary use case. Maybe it's also useful for constructing objective functions, but you already have numderive in R to do that. So basically, this is one of these. It's for the multivariate. All right, so the gist of the talk is it's a blah, blah, blah derivatives. I was just going to give up here, but I'll sort of walk you through some of the, this is really a long 20 seconds. maybe that was for you. Okay, so you can start out, you initialize it with your independent variable. The show method just shows you that I have this thing. It's a four-dimensional array. The derivative is actually a matrix. I'm showing you the diagonal. This is not the interesting case. It's just sort of the first step. So this is how you get data into one of these things. And then you can start applying functions to one of these objects, and the derivatives will be computed and carried forward for you. And in fact, here I now take that same thing, and I take it to the second power. Again, that's element-wise, and you see that very, very trickily. I'm showing you that I'm now taking independent variables as a numeric, and then the derivatives are also, again, it's a matrix, but I'm showing you the diagonal. We're sort of carrying the derivatives forward for you. But you can also use, you can perform some weird functions. You can take, you know, this thing to, you can take a cosine and take absolute value and take it to the square root power. And again, I've just applied all the rules for derivatives. I used to be a mathematician. Now I'm a hacker, I guess. So here, you can take a product of all the elements with cost and derivatives. So there's another method to get your data in. It's called addMadness, and this takes an object that has a coefficient method and an optional vcode method. So if you perform something like linear regression that has coefficients and a vcode, and so again, since this is for the multivariate delta method, I also provide a vcode method for for madness objects, which actually performs the delta method for you. So the idea is you have some estimator and you want to transform it in a way and keep the variance covariance of that. So here I performed a linear regression, and then I, for some reason, square the betas, and then I'm showing you the variance covariance as a correlation. There's another way to get data in. It's called two moments, and this computes the first and second moments of a matrix. So it's given to you in a of a vector that's given to you as a matrix of the observations. And again, here you have to when you're computing the second moment, you have to be careful about symmetry. So symmetry is one of these weird things. But here I'm taking the sigma, which is the covariance, and I'm taking the symmetric square root. So I had to figure out how to compute the matrix derivative of the symmetric square root function. So, but I did somehow. And here on the bottom, this is actually I'm now computing mu is the first moment, sigma is the covariance, and I'm computing something that's Cotelli's statistic. So this was one of the use cases that I had in mind. This is I'm computing the Markowitz portfolio. I'm grabbing the Fama-French three factors. I'm applying two moments onto it. And then I'm performing a solve. So basically, I had to figure out matrix inversion, what's the derivative of that, but it turns out it's actually very interesting. the Markowitz portfolio is you take the covariance, the invert, divide by the mean, and here I'm showing you this is the Markowitz portfolio. Here's the variance covariance of the Markowitz portfolio. This might be interesting to you if you have a large number of assets. I used to work in a hedge fund, and you're performing. You're trying to optimize your portfolio. So again, imagine you could click on that thing. My username is ShabbyChev on GitHub and on Twitter, so you can get it on Cran or on GitHub and talk to me. Great, thank you.
Absolutely no pressure, Alan.
Hi, my name is Alan Miller. You can call me Al for short. I'm going to be talking today about using R to analyze what's called the jobs crisis. And what this really comes down to is how does outsourcing of jobs and automation, robotics and using process control, computerized process control, create a situation where jobs in industries are not sufficient to absorb a growing working population, or even employed people who are already in the workforce. So automation displacing people. And basically, this is something that's been talked about since the 1930s. John Maynard Keynes first referred to it in the early 1930s, where he brought this up as a possibility. Norbert Wiener, in the post-war period, did research in cybernetics and started talking about this as a problem. But today, it's really become a problem because computer technology has advanced to the point where, in fact, this sort of automation that's taking place is really having an impact on employment. People are very concerned about it. You can see by all the kind of the popular talk about it that's taking place today. So how do you analyze this problem? Well, the first thing is you get some data, and it turns out that the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes what's called employment requirements matrices that basically describe the employment that takes place within 206 sectors of the economy based on $1 million of output for each of those sectors. Now, it's not just a question of the individual, people that are employed within that individual industry, because when you're making cars, you have people working in the auto industry, but you also have people that make the inputs that go into the auto industry, so like glass, rubber, electricity, motion pictures, government services, and things like that. So if you look at the employment requirements matrix, you look at any given column of it, it represents for that column, for $1 million of output, all of the jobs that are generated in each of the rows of the column. And the element in the matrix along the diagonal represents the direct employment, and everywhere else is indirect employment. You can calculate the total employment that's generated by just multiplying that vector times a dollar amount per $1 million, so the number of jobs that are, to get you the number of jobs that are generated. So I developed this package called REMPREC, or REMPREC, however you want to call it, that basically packages up these employment requirements matrices that the BLS publishes and provides a function interface for you to work with them to do these sort of calculations. So I was kind of surprised because really I haven't seen anybody doing this within economics, doing this sort of analysis. Turns out it's actually quite interesting. These are some of the functions that it provides. It gives you a current domestic table. You can get a table by year. You can get an international, a total employment table, which includes all production, including imports, and you can have domestic production only. So these are the kinds of things that you can compute the direct employment impact by giving it a sector number, a dollar amount of production, a year, and whether it's domestic or international, or employment in all sectors with a simple function call for a given year, whether it's domestic or all. And these are some actual numbers that I just developed it, so I haven't had a chance to use it too much. But the basic idea here is there are about seven jobs per $10 million in the textile mills and textile product sector, 69 or about 70 jobs total, so a lot of indirect employment. If you look at 1997 versus 2014, it's about a 25% decrease in employment. This is the figures for the auto industry. If you look at it, it's quite interesting. The imports are actually relatively flat. Domestic production is actually, the number of jobs declined per $1 million output is declining. And what this suggests, this is very, very preliminary, just spinning some numbers, is that imports and outsourcing isn't really the key to the problem, at least in the automobile industry, but it's more a question of automation, jobs being pushed out as a result of computers. And this is the proportion of jobs, if you sort of look at this a little bit differently. You can see that it's about the same. So anyway, what I intend to do with this is to sort of incorporate more economic statistics, productivity statistics, occupational statistics, trade statistics, sort of tied together. R is a fantastic platform for doing this kind of stuff because it basically allows you to connect data up, package it together, publish it, and show people. And I think that hopefully this will be something that can be used to really start to dig more deeply into the problem. So take a look at, it's on GitHub if you want to take a look at it. Email, I'm going to be doing a Shiny app that's going to allow you to play with it.
I'm Giuseppe Bruno from the Beco Italy, and I'm going to talk about the analysis that can be done on text documents. So text mining for the documents that are produced by central bank. And every central bank issues every month or every quarter documents describing the economic condition in the state. And the objective of this simple presentation is just to see how we can extract information from textual data and to present some statistical law for this documents applied to this document, and also some preliminary example of sentiment analysis ran on these particular issues. The central institution expressed their position both to issue of numbers, figures, unemployment rate, for example, and also through documents. And the problem is that the documents are much more used in the web, and we see that we can construct a corpus of documents from our publication, and we can extract the semantic category and the distribution of the word frequency over the text, and also some statistical feature of the text. The first law that I have examined with R is the Zipf law, and this law that is a power law that describes the frequency with which one word appear in a corpus according to its relevance. Here we have a plot with the red line describing the actual distribution and the slope, negative slope scale is the theoretical distribution. And the second law that we consider is the Ipsilon law, and it says simply that the number of the vocabulary sites is proportional, less than proportional to the size of the number of words that are used. And also for this Ipsilon, I have produced some R programs to see the adherence of these laws to the Bank of Italy corpus, and we have seen that we have a tight connection with the theory for this Ipsilon. Here we have also considered some sentiment analysis on these documents, and on this for these things we have used the QDAP package, and we have considered polarized words, the adjective, and some the negation. Some really short formulation that we consider each sentence, the sentiment for each sentence, by considering the sum of the positive and negative adjective and the number of negations that are included in the each sentiment. Here we have a simple example of the sentiment for the concluding remarks. This one document, 15 pages document that has been issued in the mid-May of 2016 from the Bank of Italy, and we see essentially a sort of a neutrality that is expressed by the governor. And some concluding remarks that we have produced some R function that builds a corpus of central bank documents, taking advantage of the TM packages and the QDAP packages. We have verified two statistical laws, the ZIPS and the IPS law, and also we have considered the readability of
Nick Elfrin. He couldn't be here today. I'm Eduardo Ariño de la Rubia, and I'm here to talk to you about how you can deploy R models as REST APIs using Domino Data Lab. So this is hopefully going to scroll. We'll see. Yes, excellent. So why would you want to deploy models? Well, there's a lot of reasons, right? One of the things that we're finding is that, you know, people are doing data science and they want to be able to expose the benefits and outcomes of that data science, that trained model, to the rest of the business users in the organization. We're finding that, you know, that people want to do it for recommendation systems, for insurance, to be able to score things. But the problem is that different languages are good for different stuff. So your business systems may be written in Java or in C#, and you want to do your modeling in Java and C#. You want to do it in R because you're a same data scientist. But it turns out that, unfortunately, your back-end system is written in COBOL or something like that. So you need to have some sort of clean interface. And there's a second problem. There's an organizational problem that comes in. The cadence of an engineering organization with their 2-week sprints, if they're agile or Lord knows what, is completely different than the cadence of a data science organization. And there's this problem, the handoff. We've actually heard from customers that data science will build a model, they'll hand it off to engineering, and it'll actually take 12 months for the engineering organization to like figure it out, implement it wrong, figure out they implemented it wrong, then go back and re-implement it right, and then by then it turns out your covariates have shifted because reality wasn't kind enough to just hang out. So what we do is we make it easy for data scientists to actually build their models inside of Domino. You go in, you open up RStudio or whatever, and you actually build your model in there. And we put in this layer of abstraction that makes it possible for you to sort of take the actual RDA file that is your saved caret model or whatever it is that you're using, push basically, say it's model.r, this is the predictive function, and it automatically builds a REST API. So it automatically handles the JSON, the serialization on serialization, it handles failover, security, logging, and all of that. And now your developers can just sort of like hit it via a REST API, which their cruddy C# app already has an object to be able to do that. Next, let's do this. All right, so I can't actually do a demo, so I've got some screenshots here. So basically here you've got some R function. It's a really straightforward function. You just got pretty quality, it takes some features, you do your call, then you return something. This is just R code. There's nothing magical happening here, right? You trained it somewhere, you've got the RDA file saved somewhere. What we let you do then is we let you go into the publish API, and you literally just say, hey, it's a file called predict.r, it's got a function in called predict.quality. You push the publish button. What we do is we spin up a Docker container, we move all your code to it, we install all the packages, we install RDA files, we bring up Nginx, we put in some code that takes the JSON, serializes it, deserializes it, we put it behind SSL security, behind API key security, and now it's just available, and you can copy paste the example code for Java or Python or whatever it is that they're using, and you can be like, hey, you can just use this model now, it's here, here's the API key, don't worry about it. This means that you as a data scientist can constantly update your model. You can do whatever it takes. So putting models into production is tough because like they have to respond quickly. It turns out if you're changing from model A to model B, you don't want all your connections to be dropped. Turns out if one server goes down, you want it to actually be able to like still serve responses. You want to be able to do it reproducibly. You want to have logging. You want to have security. And sometimes you even want to like not use the same model for 1,000 years. You'd like to maybe retrain it every once in a while. All these are the production concerns that you've got to solve whenever it is that you're moving R models into production. And there's lots of ways to do it. One of the ways to do it is to use Domino Data Lab. Let's go. Oh, such a long 20 seconds. So best practices that you should follow. It's really important that you separate your training, visualization, and prediction. A lot of this is because training might take a really, really, really long time, and you want to use a massive Amazon X1 instance with 2 terabytes of RAM. Once you've done, got your model though, you can probably run it on a smaller instance. You don't want all your training code and prediction code to live in the same place, because then you need a big box for both sides. You want to make sure your prediction functions are thread safe. This is a thing about the web, right? You're going to have lots of requests firing at you. You don't want to keep states somewhere. You want to make sure that every single request that comes in is in a brand new world. And you want to leverage some cool persistence serialization tools, because you want to be able to sort of spread it all over the place. And for that, we've really found that RDA is the best. Thank you very much.
You go tell Meg you can set us up for any
My husband actually is a computer scientist, though, and he's of the attitude of, I don't understand why you use R.
All right, you're up.
Like,
we're in the range of
R.
We're in the range of both now. Let's go.
Of course I use R. He's like, you could do this in all other computer fields AIs.
My topic is about all of the things.
You can do the same thing with this stuff. We're just like, oh my god.
Tracking down assessment using Chinese. Well, again, just Chinese. Well, a lot of people feel like clinical data scientists, we are building models every day, but it's actually not true. A lot of us actually spend a lot of time figuring out what is going on in the study we're currently running, and just trying to make sure everything's all right. So, before we start to use Shiny, we actually face two major challenges. Like, first of all, we just don't want to write those progress reports every week or every month. That's just so like redundant, and it's a waste of time. And also, another challenge is that in the old practice, the people who do clinical data management and data analysis, they are two like totally two different groups of people. It just sounds crazy. A mass at the end of the study, when the statistician actually got their hands on the study data, that they have no idea what went wrong in the study and what decisions they made. So our solution is to use Shiny to automate all these kind of process. So for each individual study, we actually build a Shiny app before the study actually starts, and we keep constantly like improve the Shiny app as the investigator actually discovered more problems, and we solved it immediately. We add that feature in, and once the feature in, we are awesome. And this is a little bit tacky part. If we think about the design pattern, well, let's skip that. I'm gonna show some screenshots as well. And these are the current project we are serving. We have, it's like six projects currently using Shiny. We just set up the Shiny server last year. And this one is just a table. And a selection, a date selection bar on the left side, but you cannot see it, that you can select two dates and compare the difference between the recruiting status between 2 days. So you can know how many people we recruited last week or last month. Like the RA can just make selection. And this one just shows how many people, like how our participants, whether or not they showed up during the study. Like, I hope this table is well designed, that it's pretty straightforward where you recognize who is actually showed up and who actually missed the visit. That's how actually these things. And this one, we actually have a study from some multi-site, they actually started at different times. So. I got a request saying that they want to know the progress of different sites, so that's it. That's just a little widget and they can take advantage of it. And you can also see the adherence rate of different sites on the right side. And this one is a little bit fancier. Well, I built it for a study. We use Apple Research Kit to do studies of the world, of the country. And you can see I use pie chart to display the counts of records we have for different studies. You can disable that. And we also build some little widgets just to help our research assistant to make sure like they have the correct list of people they contact at the very beginning of the day. And since these kind of things are very easy to make, we just made it. So here is some tips I gave for you, if you just want to quick start to jump start your team to use, start to use Shiny, and you can read that. And I also want to add on that the reason why I think like building model is great, but the reason why I think these kind of things are important is that if we cannot control the quality of the data we collected, and the study is not reproducible. And this is a constant page. I especially want to thank my team in my institution and also our community. That's fantastic in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Replacement.
I don't know. Maybe it's me.
Everybody get ready to jump.
Deep breath. Well, wait, we got the 20 second slide coming up.
20 seconds. So, how many speakers do we have left?
Basically. All right. If it's me, I want you to listen carefully because when you're listening carefully, I tell you how you can be super productive while being super lazy. So yes, that's me. I'm a PhD student, which makes me super lazy, and I'm a PhD student in computational biology in the field of cancer research. And nowadays, cancer research does not take place in the lab or in the wet lab. It's also taking place on the computer. And as you can imagine, so what we basically do is we take the patient material, like the blood, the tissue from cancer probes, and we digitalize it. We measure the activity of genes. We measure if genes are mutated, and we measure if there are more genes, of more copies of one gene than there should be. And if we did this, we basically want to share this stuff. So yeah, I did it, I found something interesting, then I want to give it to the next researcher, and I want to receive some data from other researchers. And since all this data stuff is pretty big, you don't want to send it by mail, you want to put it on some platforms. And there are a lot of platforms out there for a lot of different data types, and one platform is the TCGA, which mainly stores a lot of big data. So from raw data over normalized data, which is correct for batch effects, and some data which has gone through some pre-analyzed stuff, like every researcher is doing. They claim to do something else, but they never do. Everything is standard. And as computer scientists are cool guys, there's a website for this website, which is called Firebrowse, which basically does nothing else than keep on pre-processing these data sets. The cool thing about the Firebrowse website is it's providing a RESTful API, which means that you can directly get the data from the website into our programming environment. And I wrote a package for that. It's called Firebrowser. And mainly you can look up the website's API documentation, and it's completely perfectly aligned with the package. So you can, everything the website provides is provided by your package, and basically this is everything I have to talk about for now. Now the lazy part begins. Here you see the release dates of the API, or here you see the dates I committed the code to GitHub, and as you can see, they are not in sync. So what's basically happening, there's a new version, I'm on holiday, I'm somewhere else, I'm too lazy, I won't commit an update, everything breaks, nothing's working, horrible. So how do you get rid of that? So the Qt cat everybody knows, this is GitHub, Travis CI is hopefully also known, this is running your unit tests, and cronjob basically does nothing else than taking your script off your cronjob and running it every hour, every minute, every 7 days, how often and whenever you want to. And you can put all this stuff together to get a workflow automated. So I got the script on cronjob.org, which is checking for a new API version of the Firebrowse website every minute or every hour. And if there is a new version available, it automatically downloads the code and generates ER source code through some template stuff, which is called Whisker. You can look it up if you're interested. And if the code is generated, it's pushed to the development branch on my GitHub website. So I got everything on the GitHub branch, on the development branch on GitHub, and if it's on GitHub, it automatically gets detected by Travis CI. So hopefully the switch is now. Yes! And when it's on the development branch, it automatically gets detected by Travis, and Travis is running my pre-written unit tests, and if they break, I receive an error, and all the process stops. If the stuff is run successfully, it's getting back to GitHub. So to give you an overview, here's the whole thing.
we got the FireBrowse website, and we just check hourly if there is an update. New source code is generated and it's pushed to the development branch. And Travis CI is automatically running the unit tests for the dev branch. That's a cool thing, yeah, I doubled the time. And if there are no errors, we went back, everything's going back to the master branch, and then we are live, which is pretty cool. So I didn't do anything. We are perfectly in sync with the API version, and I don't need to do anything for that. And one might ask why I don't use Sitter, so I could use, or I could generate all the AP functions on the fly and stuff like that. I would always be up to date with the package. I could, without any regards, make a trend release, but there wouldn't be any documentation. I can create with Hitter the API client and provide documentation for that, which I can do anyway if I do it this way. So basically, thanks a lot for listening. Thank you to all the contributors on GitHub. There are a few. And yes, give it a shot. Be lazy too.
Steve Piccolo. I'm at Brigham Young University in the Department of Biology. There's my Twitter handle. I'd love to hear from any of you who have questions or comments on what I present. And I also just tweeted out a link to the code that I used to generate the figures in this car. Okay. So one type of problem that I often try to tackle in my research is to look at people in two different groups. For example, people who respond to a certain drug, compare those against people who don't, and try to identify patterns, maybe at the molecular level, that are different between those people who respond and those who don't. This is called a classification type of problem. What you do is you collect data, you take a classification algorithm, you apply it to the data, you try to identify these patterns, and then you take those patterns and you apply them to a new data set and make predictions for that new data set as to whether, for example, they respond, they'll respond or won't respond to a drug. This can be useful in clinical settings. Often these predictions, they're discrete predictions, maybe responder versus non-responder, but in other cases, with any algorithms, we can produce probabilistic predictions or a soft prediction. And these are really useful, but it's also more challenging to be able to identify a threshold where we can say, okay, these individuals we are predicting are responders or not. So I simulated a data set where we had some people who were predicted to not respond, so those are the zero samples, and some who are predicted to respond, those are the one samples, and we have, with the simulated data set, a modest ability to differentiate between these two groups. The predictions are slightly higher overall for the one group. One technique that we can use to evaluate the quality of these predictions that's commonly used are ROC curves, and AUC scores. So this type of score tries to balance sensitivity and specificity across many different thresholds. And your goal here is to get as far above this diagonal line as you can, but it's unintuitive, I think, for many people. So I developed an alternative approach, which I'm calling performance above random expectation, where we look at these predictions across many different thresholds, and we compare what our actual predictions are against what the perfect predictions would be, or what the random or permuted predictions would be, and we calculate the area between the actual and the permuted. This is just showing you a couple examples of different scenarios. For example, where you made completely random predictions, you would get a score close to zero. Or if you made perfect predictions, then your predictions, your actual predictions would overlap exactly with your maximal predictions, giving you a score of one. If we compare this against the area under the ROC curve, we see a strong correlation with that, so basically meaning that you can qualitatively interpret this score similarly to how you would an AUC score, but the pair score has some nice advantages in being able to interpret these values. So I'll give you an example here. So I simulated another data set where we had a few predictions. So for the one sample you can see at the top, there are a few predictions where they're much higher, or you know, they're really accurate for those few instances. But if you look at the ROC curve there on the right, you'll see that the ROC curve doesn't really tell you anything or indicate anything about that, and your AUC score doesn't really reflect that. whereas if we use the pair method, we can look at this graph. This graph doesn't tell us too much, but if you really zoom in close, you can see that to the right of the graph, the actual line overlaps with the maximal line, showing that for those for thresholds above about 0.4 or 0.5, you're getting good accuracy. And if we zoom in a little bit and look at the relationship between the actual and the permuted, you can see that you should, this is telling you that you should pick a threshold somewhere around 0.4 or 0.5, which is what we would expect based on what we simulated. And then also our score reflects that we're getting better than random prediction, whereas the AUC score didn't tell us that. A couple nice things, so it's similar to the AUC score. This works well with imbalanced data, so sometimes you have many more individuals from one class versus the other. So in this case, the pair score is going to be able to deal with that imbalance and give us a reasonable score. And another way it can be applied is to not only use, and the default is to use accuracy as the metric in deriving these pair scores, which is intuitive for people to understand. But in other cases, you might want to use a different metric, such as sensitivity or specificity or the F-score or something like that, and be able to identify a threshold that maximizes those other metrics. Okay, so this is a URL if you want to see the code behind this method or the figures that I used in this presentation. I'd love for you to take a look at that and give me feedback. I'm still developing and trying to refine this method. So thank you.
Two more seats in the front.
Slide stop for no one, so we dive right in. I'm going to talk about R's role in healthcare. My name is Jeff Mill. I'm with Loopback Analytics. Try again. Still no. All right. So here's the interesting thing about healthcare for those who aren't in it. It's an interesting animal in terms of an industry. It's a lot different from a lot of other ones. And over the past 20 years or so, it's undergone quite a bit of a metamorphosis. So about 20 years or so ago, the whole thing was paper-based, and a lot of people in this room are going to remember that. Paper charts getting carted all over the hospital or the doctor's office. That gave way to computerized records. You got to think Excel or targeted applications for specific workflows, not enterprise grade. That in turn, about 10 years ago, gave way to full enterprise level electronic medical records. That means everything from registration to clinical practice to billing, all captured within full robust databases. So what's exciting now is we have about 10 years worth of data in these databases to really tear apart and figure out how can we make healthcare better and more efficient, particularly more effective for patients. Obviously, R is one of the tools we're most excited about leveraging to meet those goals. All right, so despite about 20 years of rapid change, it's no exaggeration to say that the package you just ordered from Amazon was far better tracked in terms of how it got to your house, whose hands it passed through, what condition it arrived in, than a patient who's discharged from the hospital at an acute time. That's the state of medicine right now. So a good question that we can leverage to figure out how can we use R is which skilled nursing facility should a patient go to after leaving the hospital? So skilled nursing facilities, a quick way to think about them are, you go there after the hospital, if you're not sick enough to stay in the hospital, but you're not well enough to go home. It's a big area of focus right now. In fact, the Wall Street Journal, I think about 8 or 9 months ago, did a big expose about how skilled nursing behavior is changing in response to economic incentives. As a quick reminder, this isn't even really the tip of the iceberg in terms of what can be done. It's more like the proverbial snowflake on top of the tip of the iceberg. But it's a good vertical to dive into to talk about R. So how do we go about this? Step one, data acquisition. The government in the form of Medicare is really leading the way in releasing more and more data to tackle problems like this. One data set they release is a list of all skilled nursing facilities in the country ranked by quality, with 1 star being low quality, 5 star being high quality. There's about 10 or 15,000 facilities, if I remember correctly. So you grab this data, and you have to do some cleaning to it. Things like making sure the column names don't have spaces in them, make sure they make sense. You also have to do some odd things like adding zeros back to the beginning of zip codes because they're converted into integers when you download them, and you have to stick the zip codes back in. Yep. Not an uncommon problem. So what we'd like to do is take all these skilled nursing facilities and put them on a map, but you can't do that with addresses. So you have to go through and figure out, for all the addresses, what are the longitude and latitude coordinates? There's a couple different ways to do this. We wrote our own wrapper to do it, and we leverage the Google API. But effectively, we go through all of them, and we get the longitude and latitude coordinates so that we can throw the skilled nursing facilities on a map. Lots of different great mapping packages within our GGMap is exceptional, and we use it all the time. But where possible, we like to use the interactive maps. So in this case, we'll use Leaflet, so we can put all the skilled nursing facilities on a map to make it a little bit more interactive for end users. Step 5, all right. So now you've got it on an interactive map, the next logical step is to put it on an interactive dashboard. And here we use, obviously, Shiny. So what's exciting about this is that you're able to hand this to an end user, so they zoom in on any geography you're interested in and understand the skilled nursing quality in your area. No surprise, obviously, looking at the Bay Area here, it's fantastic. This is not representative of the country as a whole. So if we kind of take a step back and say, where do we start and where did we end up? I would argue that we took data and we converted it into insight. It's not just rotting on a spreadsheet somewhere. Now you can dive into your particular question of interest on your geography. And more importantly, by embedding it in something like Shiny, we've been able to convert this insight into action. So now the discharge planners, the physicians, the hospital folks, the skilled nursing facilities themselves, they can all dive into this data and figure out how do we collectively make the healthcare delivery system a little bit better. So while we're waiting, I'll say again, the Bay Area is fantastic. So if you're going to get sick here. All right, so just to wrap it up, this is the tip of the iceberg. It's that snowflake on the tip. There's so much more that R helps with. Machine learning to proactively identify the high-risk patients, regardless where they are in the healthcare continuum. Of course, the deep exploratory analytics to really dive into these mean and naughty problems that are all going to, that affect us all, obviously, in healthcare. And it's no exaggeration to say R is helping healthcare. Thank you.
Second to the last speaker.
Hi, I'm Edward Buell from Statistics Netherlands, which is the Statistical Office of the Netherlands, which is the US Census and the Labor Force, Statistics Online in one office. I'm a statistician / data scientist at this office, and I'm going to talk about chunks. So what is chunks? Can be described as dplyr or data in large text files. So who's using dplyr? And who's reading data from large text files? So what I tend to see is that my data gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So I'm working with multi-gigabyte text files, which is can be quite cumbersome. So what I typically do is I do some selection in the text file, so select columns, filter rows, derive some new variables, and then store this intermediate result for further analysis. So that's my typical workflow for pre-processing my data. And these results can be another text file or a database. But because these text files are far too big to be put in them, you could use other tools, for example, Unix tools, which are fine, but they're leaving our universe and would like to use dplyr, not set or grep and so on. But these tools are very fine, but not R-ish. So another option would be to import all data into a database and then pre-process the thing. That's not really an R solution, it's more a database solution, and also you would import many data which you would filter out or don't need, because not raw data is raw and should be clean. So it's not an efficient way. Another way would be to use ReadR and FRead, which are fantastic and they are very fast, but the resulting data frame is not memory backed up. So you end up with a very large data frame, and if your memory size is limited, that can be quite a problem. So 100 megabytes of 100 gigabytes files is quite large. So what I ended up doing was just reading a part of a file, process it, reading a part of a file, process it, reading a part of a file, process it, and that's possibly cumbersome. So enters dplyr or chunked. So what does chunked do? It automates this process for you. So you can use dplyr groups, and it's very memory efficient. So you read only one chunk at a time, and all dplyr groups or commands are required. And then when you start writing or printing, chunk by chunk is read in, and the Y verbs are played on these chunks. I use the chunk is built upon a non-architectural block, which is large ASCII files, which allows me to read in just portions of large data files. And all DPI verbs on chunk-wise objects are recorded and replayed. So it includes two extra functions called read underscore chunk-wise and write underscore chunk-wise. So you can read in the data file, or you can say that you want to start reading the data file, and you can all give all kinds of DPI verbs, and all these will be recorded. And at the moment you start writing, the chunk will be read in, and processing will start in a chunk will be written to disk. So this will be evaluated chunk by chunk, and not the whole memory will loop with your whole data file. Nice feature is also that you have column number manipulation in RStudio without reading in the whole data. So it derives this from the first chunk. So one scenario is that you want to process this, and you can also put it in a database, and you read in the data from a text file, and it will be chunk by chunk put in a database, which is different from normal things you do in DPI. Then you have to read in the whole table and then create a new table in one time. Another thing is you want to dump from a database into a text file, or make a subselection this way. It's an example where you have a database and then read chunk by chunk from the database to a text file. So everything works. Except for some things that cannot be implemented because you're working chunk-wise. So summarizing and grouping by do work, but they work on a chunk base. You can work around it. On that, on my website, there's an example of that. And we don't have arrange, write join, and full join because you need the whole dataset to be in memory for that. So if you're interested, please install chunk or visit my website.
Of this test a Monte Carlo likelihood to get an approximation to the MLE, and this is defined to be the Monte Carlo MLE. So one issue of this method is that the Monte Carlo variance increases exponentially fast in the distance between the parameter theta and the psi. We can use the same trick to approximate, to get a variance estimate, and we define that approximation is not reliable if its variance stops growing exponentially fast. So I will propose the following iterative method constrained by the variance estimate to maximize the Monte Carlo likelihood. In each iteration, we approximate the target by a first or second polynomials, and then we also transform our parameter into a space to improve the approximation. So with our fitted and low-order polynomials, we explore along the steep ascent past to find the next psi for our design center. And the iteration is terminated until we find the stationary forms for the second system. So here we give an example using the simulated base set. So we started from a psi value, which is deliberately choose to be far away from the target. So in the first row, we show the fitted contour of the low-order polynomials. The second row shows an evaluation of the Monte Carlo likelihood along the Stevie path. And the last row shows the same thing for the variance estimate on log scale. So for the first two iterations, we see that the likelihood increase along the path, but the variance estimate shows that it's not reliable at the at 2 units away from the center. So we update according to the 2-unit center away from 2 units away from the center. So after the first 3 iterations, we're already close to the maximum region, and we start to capturing the second order features of this system. So in 4th iteration, we find the stationary points within our design region, and in the 5th and 6th iteration, we try to improve our approximation by first increase the Monte Carlo sample size and then decrease the size of the design region. So the final result is given by the iteration 6. So in conclusion, we present a simulation based in likelihood inference with stable implementation and a reasonable computational time. And we have a fully automated implementation in our package and MCR-CAR, and we hope that will be soon available on Xero. And this procedure can be easily adapted to more complicated structures.
Thanks to all of our speakers. Please, if you see them,
there was one presentation more.
I see.
My presentation was moved. I also saw it. And,
which one?
It's the automated risk calculation.
Next time we do these, R will be really better at this. Do we have anybody else who thinks they're our highly automated?
So hello everybody, I'm Alex. I'm a heart surgeon from Berlin, German Heart Center. And I have a degree in computer science, however this doesn't make me a computer scientist. So this is rather simple in comparison of that what you heard before. So it's about automating risk calculation in healthcare. And how do we use risk scores in the clinical setting? So first of all, we use it for decision making. Either for differential diagnosis, when I see a patient like this, I ask myself, is it deep vein thrombosis? It's likely, but there are other diagnoses which are also likely, and so a risk score can help me. But also in the differential treatment, we use it very often, especially with the new technologies like the TAVR, I don't know whether you heard it, the transcatheter aortic valve implantation methodology for high-risk patients, and also there the risk will help me to decide is it a patient for a surgical valve or a transcatheter valve. So, however, those, there are a lot of risks out there for all sorts of diseases and states, but they are potentially underused because it's often a hassle to compute them. So very often there is only a web page available, and the SDS web page is already remarkably good across the upper hand right side. So how else are they used? So this was the clinical side, but there is also the clinical research side and the quality assurance side. So regulatory authorities use them for quality control. For instance, in Great Britain, they report the mortality rates for each surgeon, and luckily in conjunction with the risk scores. So my package focuses on the cardiac surgery relevant risk scores, which is the logistic Euroscore, the Euroscore 2, and SDS score. And these scores you see here are from the same patient, and you can see they are quite different. The logistic Euroscore is quite old. So when you use the risk score package, you get an easy interface to calculate the score, and you can use, of course, the advantage from RStudio, which gives you this, this documentation. And what is quite neat, sometimes when you have access to data, they are coded differently. So I try in the package to recognize as much as possible values which are valid. For instance, a binary value can be coded as false, as logical values as false, as zero, as f in as uppercase f or lowercase f, and this can be all recognized. And also for other risk score specific values, such as renal impairment gradient, you can enter either raw measurements like the estimate GFR, which is a measurement for renal function, and it will translate it to, let's say, moderate impairment, or you can get insert hard coded risks like it's a moderate, it's already known. And it also enables you to draw risk planes for patients. This is a typical patient risk plane, and it undergoes three different surgeries. It's redo, mitral, and aortic replacement, or isolated aortic valve replacement. And as you can could see, you have nicely different risk scores and risk planes. So also it helps you in two settings. You can calculate it on demand, and that's what we are currently implementing in the hospital system. And you can do batch calculations. So let's first do calculate on demand. So we have our patient data management system, and the patient data management system, everything gets inserted by the physician and by the nurses on admission. And then we added Plumber, which is a great package developed by Jeff Allen, which lets you easily create a web service just with comment annotation. And then the risk score getting calculated, and the response is sent to the patient data management system, and the surgeons have immediately the risk score and can do a better risk stratification and what procedure is better or not so good. On the other hand, and that was the reason why I developed the package, I was forced with such a spreadsheet, and no risk score was available. And I can now decide, do I do it by hand with the web interface, and it takes me like 60 hours, or do I do it automatically? And so I wrote the risk score package, and it's available on GitHub. And if you do this kind of research, feel free to use it. For me, it was very helpful. Thanks to the R community.